The topic of today's discussion is the relevance of spirituality to the students, to the youth of today. Today's youth, due to their extensive exposure, want some tangible reason to anything that they accept. In the past, things were different. The elders told them, and they accepted. But most of the youth today are not that submissive. They want to rationalize everything, and they want to think about themselves, think themselves about what they are going to accept and what they're going to reject, isn't it? Therefore, when it comes to spirituality or religion, they have, and most of them rather, I won't say they in general, but most of them have an inherent aversion to that. And we can't really blame them for that, because they can't just accept something because somebody told them that they should. They learned to decide for themselves. They learned to reason, and that's why they want to figure out themselves why they should accept something. And unfortunately, the spiritual topics haven't been presented in a scientific way. When I say scientific, I mean with a tangible approach to a tangible topic. To begin with, the spiritual reality is beyond our sense perception. But that reality can be perceived, that can be intellectually comprehended, provided it has been properly presented. If we can approach it under the guidance of a qualified teacher, then it becomes a reality. It's not just a matter of imagination, or it is not just a blind faith. And personally, I feel that the biggest problem in this, with this topic today, spiritualism, or which has been presented as a religion, is presented as a faith, and everyone is expected to believe whatever has been said. Such and such person said, therefore you must accept it. To the Jews, Moses said it, therefore he must accept it. To the Christians, Jesus said it, therefore he must accept it. To the Muslims, Allah said it, therefore he must accept it. And with Hinduism, at least they make a forceful presentation. You must accept. In Hinduism, unfortunately, everything is left up to the individual. It's up to you. You decide what you want to believe. And there is no no systematic presentation of the topic. And unfortunately, there is very few qualified teachers who are making the presentation. But actually, as I mentioned earlier, it's a science. Science is, as I mentioned, it's a systematic approach to a tangible topic, isn't it? Prior to that, you can say that science is experimentally verified facts. The so-called science, their presentation is first that there is a hypothesis, and based on the hypothesis there is research. And when that hypothesis is experimentally verified, then it is presented as thesis or science. But science actually means the proper and systematic approach to any subject. Like music is a science. Painting is a science. Writing is a science. Poetry is science. All these are actually science. Similarly, spirituality, the approach to understanding the spiritual reality, is a science. It is not just a matter of faith. But of course, at one point, faith is essential. But not to begin with, the faith is absolutely essential. I will come to that point. To begin with, we can use our common sense, we can use our intelligence. And that's how we can make a scientific approach. For example, if we consider the world around us, we see there are two types of objects, the inert and living. Right? And the living objects also at some point become inert. Like when somebody dies, his body becomes inert. The reality is, matter is inert. Matter by nature is inert. Matter is unconscious and inert. Now, all material objects are basically inert. But we, the living entities, we are not inert, although we have a body, we have bodies made of matter. Our bodies are made of matter, but unlike other material objects, our bodies are not inert. Our bodies are not actually abiding by the laws of matter, laws of the material nature. Rather, our bodies are defying all the laws of material nature. Like, for example, the matter is not only inert, matter cannot multiply by itself. Like, if you place two tables together, you won't get a third table out of that. Matter doesn't grow. Like this table, it may sit here for millions of years, but it's not going to grow. Whereas living entities, unlike matter or material objects, display some unusual qualities and characteristics. For example, a tiny little seed falls on the ground and eventually it turns into a seedling, and that seedling grows with time. Then every year we see that a tree is displaying various characteristics. Like in autumn, the leaves fall. Then in spring, new leaves come. In summer, flowers come and then turns into fruits. Now, although this table is made out of the same element, wood, the table will never display such qualities. You'll never find leaves are coming out of the table and fruits are growing from the table. And then we go, and this actually applies to every living entity. Not only the trees and plants and insects, and higher it grows, the degree of consciousness is higher, and its characteristics of its display of its living qualities become more and more obvious. Like, for a tree, we have to really go deep and very scrutinizingly we have to analyze to figure out that a tree has consciousness. But a human being, everybody can see that a human being is conscious. And now these are the symptoms of life. Now, can't you make a scientific approach in this way? That, like, there is a distinct difference between inert matter and living beings. When Srila Prabhupada went to the MIT, his first question was, where is the department that studies what is the difference between a dead body and a living body? Such a big university, one of the most prestigious institutions, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But they don't even consider the need for studying the difference between a living entity and a dead matter. The difference between a dead body and a living body. But it is a science. As I was pointing out, we can very easily make a scientific approach. And unless and until we make that scientific approach, I think the youth are not going to take it seriously. What do you all think? Are you going to take it just on the basis of faith? Or you want to make a scientific approach to this topic? And the Vedas are actually making a very scientific approach. Vedas are not just saying, accept on faith. Vedas are making a very, very wide open presentation that here is the subject and try to approach it from whichever point of view or from whichever perspective you want to make that approach. And that is how the Vedas are dealing with different branches. Like there are Karmakandas, Gyanakandas, there are different branches of philosophy, Naya, Vaisheshika, Uttar Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa, Sankha and Yoga. And we can see that this scientific approach, this is actually a very, very scientific approach, especially Sankha philosophy is a science. Sankha philosophy is not just a faith, it's a science. Consider this, they're analyzing. Very systematically they're analyzing the nature, the world around us. An analysis is the world is made of five different elements. What are those elements? Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Can anybody deny that? Earth means solid substance, water means liquid, fire, air, and ether. Then they're considering that there are five senses. We have five senses, eyes, ear, nose, touch, and tongue. And these five senses interact with the five elements. And five objects of the senses generate. The five objects of senses are like ether interacts with ear, sound is produced. Isn't it science? Air interacts with skin, touch is produced. Fire interacts with eyes, form is produced. At least at this point it becomes conceivable, isn't it? Like fire is giving light, and the light is interacting with our eyes, And because of that, we are able to see different forms. Consider if somebody doesn't have eyes, he won't be able to see the forms. Or we may have our eyes, but if there was no light, we won't be able to see any forms. The water interacts with tongue, taste is produced. Earth interacts with nose and smell is produced. So in this way, the five objects of the senses are produced. Then they analyze that the body has five working senses, hands, legs, belly, anus and genitals. Through these senses, one becomes active. These are the working senses. Then they consider that there are three subtle substances. Their mind, intelligence and false ego. So, we got 20 plus 3, 23. Then they considered that there is the sum total of the material ingredients out of which the entire material creation has come about. And that is called Mahat-tattva. But then they considered that all these 24, through these 24 considerations, they have analyzed the entire creation, entire material nature. But then they considered that all these 24 considerations are objective in nature. They're objects. They're objective. But objects cannot exist without the subject. Does it make sense? Does it sound scientific? Can the object exist without the subject? If I am not here, will the room exist for me? If you are not here, whatever is happening here, will it matter to you? Isn't it? So the subject, who is the subject? The subject is I. Right? Does it sound scientific? Now see what another very scientific approach they are making from this point. That I am here, that's why I am all these are existing. Right? Now, the entire material creation has been analyzed through these 24 considerations. But I am not there in those 24 considerations. I am existing beyond that. Therefore, I don't belong to the material nature. I belong to somewhere else. Right? Hence, the spiritual reality. Beyond this material reality, beyond this material nature, there is another reality from where we all came. And we are non-material. We are not material. Rather, we are spiritualizing this material nature. The spirit souls, consider this body made of matter is defying all the characteristics of matter. Why? Because I am present in this body. The body is life means spiritualized body. When the body is spiritualized, the body is alive. And why the body is spiritualized? Because I, the soul, is existing in that body. And the moment the soul leaves the body, I'm sure everybody knows what happens. The body becomes dead. Dead means the dead body made of matter becomes dead again. The body made of matter, body made of dead matter, becomes dead again. So it's not surprising, because to begin with, the body is made of dead matter. So it is a dead body. This body is actually a dead body. But because of the presence of the soul, the body is alive. So in this way, Shankar, very systematically analyzing. Actually, Shankar means analytical study. They're analyzing. So the I, here also I must mention that in Sanskrit, the word I is called Atma. In Sanskrit, Atma means I. So Atma or I belong to the spiritual reality. Now here also they didn't stop. So with this 25, beyond the 25 considerations, with 24 considerations they analyze the entire material nature. Then The 25th consideration, they are actually transcending the material nature and approaching the spiritual reality. And still they didn't stop at that. Just I am a spiritual being was not the ultimate conclusion. They went beyond that. There are many eyes, and all these eyes are minute, minute units, spiritual units. I have my eye, you have your eyes. Now anything that is minute and many must have a source, right? So that source of all the eyes is the Supreme I, or Param Atma. So in this way, through 26 considerations, they analyzed both the material and the spiritual reality. Or they are actually helping to transcend the material nature and step into the spiritual nature. Now here, the 24 considerations that we analyzed can be experimentally verified. As I said, if the definition of science is experimentally verified facts, then we can say that up to this point we can experimentally verify them. But to go beyond that, we have to have faith. At that point we need faith. Not to just begin with, we need faith. Yes, and to begin also we need faith, just as when you are learning the alphabets from your mother, your mother said this is A, and you accepted this is A, right? And this is B, you accepted. And in due course of time, it has been experimentally verified that A is A and B is B. When you grew up and started to read, it has been proven that the alphabets are as they have been taught. So for that matter, any subject, to make the initial approach, we have to have the essential faith. But the faith must be imposed upon the right source. The qualified teacher must guide us, and then only the faith becomes worth its while, not otherwise. If due to blind faith, so many people are being misled on this spiritual topic, because the teachers don't really know what they're talking about. When the teachers are ignorant, what are they going to teach? Therefore, there is an acute crisis in the spiritual topic today. All kinds of unfortunate things are going on in the name of religion today. And it is because, first, it hasn't been approached in a scientific way, and it hasn't been presented in a scientific way. So again, I'll go back to the point that if the youth haven't seriously accepted the spiritual topic or the spiritual approach to the spiritual subject matter, we can't really blame them, because the presentation hasn't been made in a scientific way. But on the other hand, if we make a very scientific presentation or make them to understand that it's a science, if we remind them it's a science and make them approach that science in a proper way and a proper guidance, then I'm confident that many other youth will be interested in this subject. So here, probably I can ask you all, why are you here today? Because, is it because the presentation has been made in a scientific way, through the way ISKCON has been presenting it, this topic, they're doing it in a scientific way, or is just out of your some sentiment or some other reasons that you have accepted this process? Anyway, I know you have the, you know the answer. But the thing is, if we want the youth to be involved, the presentation must be made in a very, very scientific way, because today's youth are rational, deep-thinking individuals. Therefore, if we want them to be interested in this topic, the presentation has to be made in a scientific way. Now, I will ask you, do you all believe in the spiritual reality? How many of you do believe in the spiritual reality? Please raise your hands. How many of you believe that beyond this material existence, there is another reality? Thank you. Thank you. Almost all of you have. And so that is the most wonderful thing about Srila Prabhupada's presentation. Prabhupada didn't present it as a faith. Prabhupada presented it as a science. And it's interesting to note that Srila Prabhupada went to the West. Srila Prabhupada went to America in the mid-60s, when youth of America was actually revolting against the existing setup. Everything that was existing at that time in the society, they wanted to rip it apart. They just wanted to define. And those who became attracted towards his teachings, is very interesting to note that most of them were young, in their teens or early 20s. And these individuals became attracted to Srila Prabhupada. And they accepted the process, or they accepted the teachings of Srila Prabhupada so sincerely that they dedicated themselves completely to this mission. And they are the ones who went to different parts of the world to help Srila Prabhupada to spread this movement. Why? Because Srila Prabhupada made them realize that spiritual subject matter is science. He presented it in an absolutely scientific way. And he wanted them to ask questions. He made it very clear to everyone that if you have any question, if you have any doubt, bring it out. If you have a question, we have the answer. So that also, I will also request you all, if you have any question, please don't hesitate to ask. Maybe at this point I'll invite some questions. And somebody can probably give some paper and pen, just in case somebody wants to write the questions. But in the meantime, if somebody wants to ask some questions, please feel free. Yeah.
I have to look for that question, for that answer. The gentleman asks him that how can we see God, or whether we can see God or not. And Prabhupada replies that it is through the spiritual eyes that one can see God.
Yeah.
And how can we prove this scientifically, that we can really see God with spiritual eyes, and how do we get these spiritual eyes?
Very good. Very good. Yeah. You see, with our material senses, or with our material eyes, to be precise, we can only see material objects. These eyes are fit only to see material objects, right? But God and the souls, they're not material, they're spiritual. Therefore, these eyes are not properly equipped to see the spiritual reality or the spiritual objects. But does it mean because the eyes cannot see, they do not exist. No, they do exist. And as I was saying, like, we may not be able to see with our eyes, but we can actually understand, or we can comprehend through our intelligence. Like, we can comprehend through our intelligence in the sense, yeah, switch it off. Yeah. So I'll give you an example to make that point. Like, it happened with one of the most eminent scientists of the world. But since there may be some controversy, I don't want to use his name, but I'll just make the point. A scientist had a friend. The friend was a philosopher. The scientist was a believer. The scientist used to believe in God. He was a theist. Whereas the philosopher friend was an atheist. And often they used to have arguments about existence of God. So one day, the philosopher friend came to the scientist's laboratory and he saw the model of the solar system and where different planets were moving around the sun by the arrangement of gears and levers. And he asked him, the philosopher friend asked the scientist, "Oh, what a wonderful model. Who made it?" So he said, "Nobody made it." He said, "How can it be possible? Somebody must have made it." But the scientist kept on insisting that nobody made it. But of course, the philosopher wouldn't believe that. And he kept on insisting that you must have made it. Then he told him, the scientist told his friend, "Look, when I point out to the model of the solar system, just a tiny little model of the solar system, and tell you that nobody made it, you don't believe me. But when I point out to the night sky and show all these innumerable stars and planets are maintaining such a beautiful order, and I tell you that there must be a creator behind that, you don't want to believe me. See how foolish you are." So, in this way, at least with our intelligence, we can comprehend that there is somebody whom we cannot see, but he is there. Right? So, intelligence is about the only faculty we have that can grasp the spiritual reality to some extent. But in order to properly perceive the spiritual reality, we have to develop our spiritual senses. Now consider, our spiritual senses are actually our real faculties. Like, our senses are active, our senses are perceiving because the self is there behind that. Eyes are able to see because the soul is there with his consciousness. Now, what is happening, the consciousness or the senses of the soul are actually spiritual by nature. We have a body. Beyond this material body, we have a spiritual body endowed with spiritual senses. And these senses, material senses, are only an extension, the external extensions of those faculties of the spirit soul. An example can be given. See, matter in itself or by itself cannot perceive. Right? Like, I have these glasses. The glasses cannot see. But it is because the glasses are tuned up to my eyes, the glasses are able to see or enhancing my perception. Similarly, the eyes, which are made of matter, are able to see because the soul is there behind that with its consciousness. But unfortunately, through this body, our consciousness is being projected towards the material nature. And that's why we are caught up in this unfortunate illusion. We are thinking that this body is the self and what we are perceiving is the reality. But actually, the self is the reality. Real reality is the self. And the self is endowed with consciousness which has been projected to the external world through the body. But when the consciousness is projected to God, to the spiritual reality, then the spiritual senses will become awakened and the spiritual senses will be able to perceive the spiritual reality of God. It's a matter of withdrawing our projection from the external to the spiritual. Make sense? Okay, now I want to make another point here. That is, you know, what causes us to develop that faculty, the spiritual faculty? Love. Love is what awakens our spiritual senses, our spiritual identity. Love towards God. You see, the Brahma Samhita is describing that premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena. When the eyes become anointed with love and devotion to the Lord, santas sadaiva hridayeshu vilokayanti jang shyama sundaram achinta guna swarupam. When our eyes become anointed with love and our consciousness is projected towards the Lord with devotion, then we see Him where? At the depth of our hearts. Hridayeshu. Because why heart? Because heart is the seat of the spirit soul. And it is the spirit soul that perceives, not the head. Head is actually the seat of the mind, which is the internal sense. And all the senses are converging into the mind, in the head, through the nervous system. All the nervous system is what, biologically we can consider. Our sense perceptions are actually a matter of our nervous system, right? And the nerves are converging in the spinal column, spinal cord. And the spinal cord is coming up to the brain center, right? And all the material senses are perceived through the brain, right? But that is the external direction. All our external perceptions are perceived through the brain. That's one world. But the other world, the spiritual world, is perceived through the heart. And on top of everything, the Lord is situated in our heart as the super soul. He is there. And we can see Him. And that is how the gate to the spiritual reality opens up. So that is how we have to develop our spiritual senses, and that is how we can see God. Thank you. Your name? Ashish Sharma. as you said, there is the Paramatma and the individual soul. My question is that the individual soul, everyone of them is part of that Paramatma. How can we realize that each one of us is related to each other through the Paramatma, thereby get over our selfishness? I'm sorry for the bad handwriting. I can't talk properly as I have had an operation recently on my tongue. Okay, doesn't matter. I could read your handwriting, no problem. So it's a nice question. I will read again. As you said, there is the Paramatma and the individual soul. My question is that the individual soul, every one of them is a part of the, every individual soul is a part of the Paramatma, and everyone is related, and each one of us is related to each other through that Paramatma, thereby get over our selfishness. Yes. You see, the material nature is the nature, or material world is the world where we put ourselves in the center. Or I can say, material world is the world where we have the opportunity to put ourselves in the center. And the spiritual world is the world where God is the center. Therefore, spiritual world is called the absolute truth. Sattam Param Dhimahi. The spiritual reality is the absolute reality or the absolute truth. Whereas material nature is false. Because no matter how much we try to put ourselves in the center, we'll never be the center of everything. But we have the faculty to think that we are the center, and that's why it's called illusion, illusory. It's an illusion to think that I'm the center. Who am I? Won't it be ridiculous if an ant thinks that I'm the center of everything? It's because of me that the whole creation is existing. But an ant is thinking the same, thinking that way. An ant also is thinking that I am the center of everything. Because in material nature, everyone is thinking that way. Because they're putting themselves in the center, naturally, everyone is selfish. Everyone is concerned about his own benefit. Sometimes they may extend their area of selfishness, or sometimes they may appear to be benevolent, but actually it is nothing but extended selfishness. I'm not concerned about myself. I'm prepared to sacrifice myself for the sake of my family. I'm prepared to sacrifice myself for my nation. I'm prepared to sacrifice myself for the entire humanity. But actually it's an extended selfishness. But the reality is, Krishna is the center, God is the center. Because He's the supreme creator, because He's the supreme maintainer, He is the center of everything. He is actually controlling everything. We are not controlling anything. We don't have any ability to control anything. If you go deep into, even biologically, if you go deep into it, you will see you can't even lift your hand yourself. It is happening due to some arrangement of some other forces, which our scriptures are saying is caused by gunas and karma. There are two factors that are working, modes of the material nature and the action-reaction principle. That is what is causing us to act. Just like a puppet is being controlled by papetia through the strings, we are also being, we are dancing like a bunch of puppets. And who are the puppeteers? The demigods, who are controlling different modes of the material nature, and through that they are actually making us dance or making us act the way we are acting. But of course there is another consideration that is called will. Anyway, in order to answer this question, I'll just stick to the point. The point actually is, we can get rid of our selfishness only when we recognize the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or the Super Soul, Paramatma, as the center of everything. And we all are related to each other through Him. We all are parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, in order to become related to each other, we have to recognize our relationship with Him first. Like, different parts of the body are related to the body. That's why they're functioning in perfect harmony, right? The hand picks the food, puts it in the mouth. And the mouth chews the food and then passes it down to the stomach. In this way, they're working in harmony as different parts of the whole. But if the hand is severed, from the body. Will the hand be able to cooperate with the other parts of the body? No. Therefore, to get rid of our selfishness, we have to recognize the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and our relationship with Him. And through Him, we'll be able to recognize our relationship with every part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the only way to get rid of our selfishness is to develop our relationship with the Lord. Do you think that advancement in modern science, say, for example, quantum mechanism, biotechnology, biophysics, etc., may ultimately prove the existence of the Supreme Lord, at least to some extent, theoretically, which may make a platform for experimental study into these gray areas? You see, it is not the subject that is what really matters. It's the individuals who are probing into those subjects. And on top of everything, is the teacher that actually matters. Is the teacher who has the solemn responsibility to teach his students about the existence of another reality, transcendental, which is transcendental to the material nature. Unless and until the teachers guide them, or unless and until one comes across a teacher, one will not be able to understand this subject. Like, for example, in today's world we are seeing all these science, all these branches of studies are actually atheistic. Do you know something, that modern science, they have a specific agenda, or what should I say, a specific objective, not to accept God. If a scientist at some point says, well, we can't go beyond that, so we leave it up to, there must be God. You know what the scientific world will say that? What the scientific world will tell him? They say he's a cop-out. Are you familiar with the expression cop-out? So that is what the modern science is like. Therefore, modern science, it's not that some scientists are not accepting, they are accepting. Like, there's a good number of scientists today, very, very eminent scientists today, are actually entering into another realm that is called consciousness. They're openly admitting that the modern science is not touching that subject, which is most essential, the area of consciousness. Now, some of them are trying to make an approach, scientific approach to consciousness. Now, this modern science hasn't. And also, if you consider the progress of modern science, I'll try to say it briefly. You know how the modern science came to this area of a blatant atheistic approach? You see, the early scientists, if we see, most of them were actually believers. In those days, practically everybody believed in God. They didn't actually defy God. They accepted that everything is being controlled by God. Whatever is happening is God's arrangement. But they wanted to find out why things are happening in a certain way. Like, as you know, Newton, when he saw the apple falling, his simple consideration was why the apple is falling down on the ground. Why doesn't the apple go up or go in some other way? His approach was to find out why certain things are happening in a certain way. So the initial approach of the scientists were like that. Let's find out. But then they invented clock. And actually when they invented clock, it was a big thing. It was something like going to moon. Like it was a big thing, big achievement, you know. They invented clock. And now, and then they concluded, I mean, that was their biggest achievement, and that made them really puffed up, arrogant. And they started, they concluded that they compared the affairs or happenings of the material nature is something like the working of a clock. So just as, you know, you wind the clock and the clock keeps on moving, so they concluded that God has set the mechanism in, and now he is gone. He is not involved. And things are happening due to that arrangement, just like, you know, winding of a clock. Now, as they say, that first you send someone in exile, and then you kill him. You see, when the kings used to have some rebel or some enemy, they would not kill the king in public or in the country. Because if they did, then there would be a big hue and cry. So in order to avoid that hue and cry, they would actually send that person in exile, and then they will execute him in exile. So in a similar way, first they exiled God, and then they killed him. Now God is dead. So modern science approach is that. Now God is dead. There's no. I mean, if at all there was God, he is dead. And now their thing is that there is no God. Everything is a matter of accident, chance happenings. Accidentally, some atoms and molecules came together, and there came life. Life came out of some chance assembling of atoms and molecules. And so that is their understanding in total defiance to the existence of God. And they say that, yes, we'll make life out of matter, but give us some time. We'll do it tomorrow. But that tomorrow never comes. Prabhupada used to make that challenge, that if life came out of matter, then all the matters are there. Why don't you create some life out of all the matter? You have your big, big laboratories. All the chemicals and everything are there. So why can't you make life out of that? But to speak of life, at least make an egg. And if you can't, then a chicken is a better scientist than you are. Prabhupada was very outspoken about this, because he used to think that the scientists are causing a big, great harm to the thinking of today's man because of all the misconceptions and false propaganda. But the reality is, God created everything. And the reality is that matter is not everything. Beyond matter, there is a spirit soul. And it's the spirit soul which is sustaining the matter. Not that matter gave rise to soul. Rather, the soul is sustaining the material world. The body is alive because of the presence of the soul. When the soul leaves the body, body becomes dead. Here also Prabhupada made another challenge to the scientists. He says, okay, here's a dead body and you have all the chemicals. If it's just a matter of chemical reactions, you have all the chemicals and here's a body. Why don't you bring back life to the dead body? You know what the answer is. They'll say tomorrow. And Prabhupada actually very boldly once declared that all the scientists are bluffing. They all are bluffing. Somebody told Prabhupada that after all they invented so many nice things. Prabhupada said, okay, give them credit for all the things that they have done. but not for what they're claiming that they're going to do. If they've invented the aeroplanes, okay, fine. It's wonderful. You have invented television, you have invented radio, you have invented telephone, you have invented computers, and fine, yes, we give you the credit for that. But what is that area where they are inventing all these things? On the material plane. So yes, on the material plane you get the credit, but don't claim that you are going to do something that is due to the presence of the spiritual reality. Don't try to take credit for the spiritual reality. And don't try to deny the existence of God. Don't become God because, don't claim that you are God because you have invented aeroplanes. Don't claim that you have become God because you have invented atom bombs. And you may say, well, we are not claiming that we are God. But when you say God doesn't exist and you are the doer, then you are actually placing yourself in his position. So although you are not openly saying you are God, but indirectly you are claiming that you are God because you are denying the existence of God, who is the supreme creator, and you are trying to take the credit for everything that's happening and that's going on in this world. So, there are some more questions. The series of scriptures, including Sankhya Darshan, Gita Upanishad, etc., were conceptualized and prepared around thousands of years back. Why couldn't we update those scriptures? Why we are trying to stick to those? Over time, every concept is supposed to grow and attain maturity. Probably this has not happened to our scriptures, and we just try to revalidate the old concepts without making any improvement. Okay. But the point actually is, when you are dealing with the absolute truth, it is absolute truth all the time. Like, for example, can you say, people said 5,000 years ago the sun rises in the east. Now I have to come up with a new concept? Does anybody become as stupid as that to say that now I have to come up with a new concept? When you're dealing with the absolute truth, it is always absolute truth. It is unchanging. It's eternal. It's everlasting. So what Krishna said in Bhagavad Gita is good for all time. That's why there's no need to change those concepts. There's no need to revalidate. How are you going to revalidate? Say, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying that the body grows from childhood to old, to youth to old age. Now, will it be proper to say that 5,000 years ago, the one used to grow from childhood to youth to old age, and then he used to die? But now, we have to revalidate that concept? No. Actually, when you're dealing with the absolute truth, it holds good for all time. Bhagavad Gita, also you'll notice in Bhagavad Gita, at the beginning of the fourth chapter, Krishna actually told Arjuna that this knowledge I gave to Vivashvan, the sun god, at the beginning. Imang Vivashvate Yogam Praktavan Ahamapayam Vivashvan Manave Praho Manur Ikshakuve Avravit. Now I gave it to Vivashvan, the sun god. Then he gave it to his son Manu. Manu gave it to his son Ikshaku. And in this way, through a line of Rajarshis, the saintly kings, this knowledge was flowing through a disciplic succession. So we can see Krishna gave this knowledge not only 5,000 years ago, Krishna gave this knowledge to the sun god billions of years ago. And just as this knowledge this knowledge held good billions of years ago, same way it was valid 5,000 years ago, and is still valid today. There's no question, there's no need to revalidate it. But what we have to do is we have to probe into it and find what the reality actually is. And the reality that Krishna is pointing out in Bhagavad Gita, or the reality that all the Vedic scriptures are pointing out, is that that beyond this material reality, there is a spiritual reality. And we all, the spirit souls, came from the spiritual reality. Oh, I see, okay.
How can you know it, be very sure that it was absolute truth? And because the original something around, say, 5 years back. How can you know that it is absolute truth? What is the scientific basis?
Scientific basis. Okay. Did you read Bhagavad Gita? Yeah. Then, yeah, okay, so if you didn't read it, then how am I going to explain it to you? You see, if you don't open your eyes and see that the sun is rising in the east, how am I going to prove it to you that the sun actually rises in the east? So the first thing I'll request you is please read Bhagavad Gita. And we'll be here, we'll be open, we'll be prepared to speak to you when any question you have pertaining to that subject. Now, okay, I'll just give you some brief ideas about what has been spoken in Bhagavad Gita. You see, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, the first thing that he is establishing is the difference between the body and the soul. Like this body, we have this body, and generally we consider that this body is ourself. We are these bodies. But the reality is that we are not these bodies. These bodies are just an external covering, and we are the soul, the self. And in order to make us understand that point, Krishna is giving an example that the body changes from boyhood to youth, to old age. But in spite of the change of the body, the self doesn't change. For example, like when you're 5 years old, what was the shape of your body? It was a small little body, right? And today you're grown up and you have... that body is not existing, right? That 5-year-old body is not there. But you relate to that body. When I was 5 years old, right? When I was 10 years old, when I was 15 years old, right? So, in spite of the change of the bodies, you do not change, right? You, the I, is constant, right? Now, here Krishna is making another point here, that the body is the external covering of the soul, just as we wear a dress. The dress is not the self. Dress is just an outer covering of the body. Similarly, this body made of matter is the external covering of the soul. And in this way, he is establishing the existence of the soul and identifying that the soul is the owner of the body, the proprietor of the body. It's my body. Right? Not that I am this body, but this body is mine. So, I am separate from the body. Right? And then he's establishing what is the soul. He's saying that the soul, it never dies, nor it was ever born. Na jayate mriyateva kadachin. The soul was never born. The body was born, but the soul was never born. Nor will the soul ever die. Who dies actually is the body. Who is born is the body. When the soul accepts a new body, it's called birth. And when the soul gives up the old body, that is called death. And the period in the body, the existence of the soul in the body from birth till the end is called life. So Krishna is saying, tatha dehantara prapti. You see, when we die, we actually leave the body, but we continue to exist and we transmigrate from one body to another body, just as we had been transmigrating continuously in this body. This body is continuously changing, and that's why we see the body is changing from childhood to boyhood to youth, etc. The soul is transmigrating continuously even in this body, and ultimately when he gives up this body, he transmigrates into another new body. Right? So now you tell me, is there a need to revalidate this fact? Huh? Yeah. Yeah, the brain is the center of the nerves. And the brain and the nerves are carrying the impressions of the senses. And the brain is actually the seat of the mind. So through the brain, what we are doing is we are relating to the material world through our senses. But consider the beyond the brain or beyond the mind, which brain, instead of the brain, I'm using the expression mind, because mind is actually relating to all those, mind is perceiving all those impressions that we are experiencing. But beyond that is the self, the I. Right? Sometimes, you see, the mind is not active, but still we continue to exist. Right? A person in coma, his brain stopped functioning. Is he still existing? Therefore, just brain or mind cannot be identified as the self. The self is beyond the mind, even beyond the intelligence. You have a question here? Okay.
People that
the soul never dies, just converts the body. Yeah. But I would like to say that
if it is so, then the number of the population of India at the time of independence was 3 million. Now it is 1 billion. Then how come this?
Do you think only the human beings have souls?
Yes,
I am asking you. I got your question.
But if suppose there are some souls in the... I told you, I got your question. But do their souls have different? What do you call existence?
The point. I told you. I got your question. The number. Which number increased? The number of human beings. Like what? What about the trees and plants? What about the insects? Right? Do they have souls? The insects have souls. So the number of. Did you count all the insects and worms? No, human beings are developing at the cost of those trees and plants. I mean, you are thinking the number of human beings increased, but did you consider how many trees and plants have been wiped out? How many animals have been slaughtered? How many insects have been eliminated? So that is not the way to count it. You see, the number of spirit souls are innumerable, even in this material nature. Actually, when you wave your hand through the atmosphere like this, you are coming in contact with billions of souls, billions of living entities. So just by considering that since the number of human beings increased since the time of independence, the number of souls have increased. that is not the consideration. Is there any scientific justification of life after death? Is there any scientific justification of life after death? Well, when you say scientific, what do you actually mean? Scientific, do you mean by saying scientific that we have to experimentally in your laboratory verify that it happened, or we can take the references from other sources? Like, for example, look at most of the other religions, you know. Not only in our scriptures. In our scriptures there are umpteen, you know, innumerable examples of the continuity after death. Like, for example, Bhishma, in his previous life, he was one of the Vasus. He was cursed by Vasishtha, and he was born as a human being, and that was Devavrata or Bhishma. King Bharat, in his next life, he became a deer. And then, after the deer body, he became a self-realized soul known as Jarabharat. Even in Christianity, there is a concept that John the Baptist was Elijah reborn. Now John the Baptist was Elijah reborn. What does it mean? Life after death? So in this way we can see that there are so many such examples. And if you consider scientific, experimentally verified facts, then in the West, an extensive research is going on this topic, life after death. Like there are many such examples of individuals who remember their past lives. And India is a very big source of their informations. And now, the main point that to scientifically understand this, we have to understand what the difference between body and the soul and what life and death actually mean. As I just mentioned, that death means departure of the soul from the body. Now, if you understand that point, it becomes crystal clear that, yes, one continues to exist even after death. Don't you feel we have a lot of counter-arguments to prove any of our points? Don't you feel we have a lot of counter-arguments to prove any of our points? Which points? Whose question is this? What do you mean by that? Okay.
Just because we cannot agree with defense theory, he comes up with something like our own way of thinking, like that demonstration, because it was to the level of Buddhism. Neither can we prove defense theory. So don't you feel like, now you said that we cannot see, but that's not our eyes are not like to see. So don't you feel like we have that every...
Well, okay. Yeah. Okay. The point is, you see, first of all, you have to use your common sense, right? And the common sense is the points that I'm making. Is there any difference between a dead body and a living body? What's your answer to that? There is a difference. What's the difference? Tell me, what's the difference? Why not? No life. What causes life? Yes. You do not know. You do not know because you didn't get the information from proper source. So to get the information, you have to approach the proper source. If you want to become, say for example, what's your occupation? What's the subject you studied? Physics. Okay, to study physics, did you have to go to study under some teacher? With the guidance of some books? Right? Could you become an expert in the subject, just sitting down without making any endeavor? No. Now, similarly, this is a subject. Now, if you want to understand this, you have to study under the qualified teachers and following certain specific books. And the informations that are provided in the books, you understand, like, is there a person... subject. So that's the point. Right? There may be thousands of counter-arguments, but who cares? Right? Like, for example, you studied physics. If some fool comes with some counter-arguments about what you are saying, will you give a damn? Okay. Is the initial faith gifted by Krishna, or it is due to proper utilization of our free will? The initial faith is up to you to utilize. Just like when you are a child and you are learning alphabets from your mother, the faith was there on your part that my mother is saying that this is A, therefore I accept that this is A. Right? So, similarly, when you approach the spiritual subject matter, the initial faith has to be there on your part. You have to be willing to learn. And just consider, anything that you learned, initially you had to have the faith. No one could force that faith in you. And therefore, sometimes we find that some people, those who don't have the faith, those who don't want to accept, you can't make them understand. There are so many people who are totally atheistic. What do you do with them? I will say, if you're intelligent, just avoid them. Well, don't waste your time. You'll never be able to convince them, as long as they themselves don't want to hear. I don't know, what is this? This is you? Anyway, I'll read it out. I don't know who it came from. It's an announcement, actually. It says, every Tuesday, 6 p.m. at... okay. You know, it was an announcement that every Tuesday at 6 p.m. at 22 Gurusada Road, there's a discourse on science of self-realization, and after that there's a course of mantra meditation. Why are, anyway, gods controlling us? Oh, why are demigods controlling us? Why are we qualify for action of demigods? Why do we not get or awarded by moksha?
Why are we tempting for the acts of demigods? Why don't we get the moksha?
Okay. Why are we, you didn't say guilty, you say, why are demigods controlling us? That was the first question. The second, why are we guilty, okay, yeah, for actions of demigods? Yeah, it's not that we are not doing anything. You see, this material nature is set up with a remote functioning system called guna and karma. There are three modes of material nature. And there is a principle called action-reaction principle. That is called principle of karma. Or to present it scientifically, do you remember the law of motion? No, you don't know. Okay, there is a Einstein's, Newton's second law of motion. To every action, there is an equal and opposite. That's the third law, right? The third law is, to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Now that also applies to every individual, not only in the material objects, but to us also. As you sow, so shall you reap. As you act, you'll get the reaction accordingly, right? Now that setup is being managed by the demigods. They're not whimsically doing anything. They're simply arranging things according to this principle of guna and karma. Like when you act in certain way, the reaction takes place in that way. There are three modes, three gunas: sattva guna, raja guna, and tamo guna. Mode of goodness, mode of passion, and mode of ignorance. Now, when you act in the mode of goodness, you get the reaction in a certain way. When you act in the mode of passion, you get the reaction in some other way. When you act in the mode of goodness, you get the reaction in a specific way. Right? Now, as we act, we become liable to the reactions. Right? And that system is being controlled by the devas, demigods. Yeah, but before you think with your brain, the demigods are actually making all the arrangements.
Due to brain, we are doing something, and the self is separate from the brain. So why I is being sent again as a demigod?
Okay, you may be thinking with your brain, and I may be separate from the brain, but when you act in a certain way, you are going to get a reaction. Right? Like you steal, then the police catches you and takes you to the court. And what do? The judge in the court, does he reward you? No, I'm asking you. What does the judge do? Punish you. Right? But when you do something good, what does the government do? Rewards you. Right? Now who controls that? There is some authority, right? Like for punishment there is the court and the judges. Because you are acting and you are suffering. You are getting the reactions of your actions. Right? There you are involved. Your I is involved because you are acting in a certain way, and accordingly you are getting the reaction. Now if you act, I don't get the reaction, you get the reaction. That's how your I is involved. Alright?
This body is very close, it can be thrown out again, new body can be taken up by the eye. So body should get punished. Now body is dying. Body has been killed. So why eye is again taking new
body? Okay. Right. As long as you are identifying with your body, whatever is happening to the body, you are thinking that it's happening to you. Right? That is how the I is involved. But when you think that you are not this body, then, and if you not only think, but if you realize that you are not this body, then whatever happens to the body will not affect you. I'm talking about you, don't think about the person. Speak about you. Yeah, but the coma, he's in coma, so he doesn't have his consciousness. He may not be doing anything right now, but in the past he has done so many things. Right? If you stole some money yesterday and you are taken to the court today, can you tell the judge that I'm not stealing now, why are you punishing me? So you see, our past actions, we become liable to our past actions as well. It is up to you whether you're going to relate yourself to the mind and the body. I'm telling you, why don't you try to understand what I'm saying? I'm saying that as long as you identify yourself with the body, you will be liable to whatever is happening to your body. Right? Think over it. Right? And then you can come back. How will we control our mind, intelligence, false ego, through or with the help of spiritual science? Shall we, by faith, depend on Supreme God or... whose question is this one? No name. Can you just explain what you wrote, please? I mean, what's your question, actually?
In this material world, how will you control our mind through all those discourse and all those things that are happening right now in several places? So how will you control our mind? So this is my question. Through spiritual science.
Through spiritual science. Okay. You see, through spiritual science, when you study the spiritual science, then you recognize that you are a spirit soul and you are not this body. And as a spirit soul, you are related to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the Supreme Spirit, who is the Supreme Source of everything. And then you surrender unto Him. And by surrendering unto Him, you learn to control your mind, your intelligence, and your false ego. The spiritual science will help you understand God. It will help you to take shelter of Him, to depend upon Him, and leave everything up to Him. Just like a child doesn't have to worry about himself, because he knows that his parents are there to take care of him. Similarly, when we surrender unto God, then we don't have to worry about anything ourselves. We depend upon Him. And this is how we become free from all anxiety that's caused by our mind, etc. It is said, work is worship. As a doctor, I get opportunity to come in contact with ailing people and treat them. Though it is my profession and I earn my bread and butter through treating patients, I believe that by my attitude of helping sick people, showing compassion and empathy for them, going slightly beyond just professional service, I am giving a service to God. I do not have any routine religious activity, but still I am close to God. Am I right in my thinking? May I ask whose question was this? Okay, please come forward. Yeah. Thank you. So you're a doctor. Yeah, very good. Yes, it's nice that you are serving, you are helping people, and you are treating the sick people and curing them. But still, it is not exactly service to God. Or by doing that, you are establishing your relationship with God. You're doing good thing, you're doing good work. But you see, when it comes to developing a relationship with God, you have to know who God is. And you have to know what is your obligation towards Him, what you are supposed to do to Him. Like for example, if I ask you that you're treating your patients. By treating your patients, you are helping them. But by earning the money, you are taking care of your parents, you are helping them. But there are so many other people who are not actually receiving any benefit from your service. Right? This kind of service are just meant for just the individuals that you are helping, right? And also, the people that you are treating, you're helping them, but you cannot give them the absolute help. In spite of all the doctors and all the medicines, people are dying, right? People will die, right? And when they die, if they die in ignorance, without the proper understanding, then their life is actually gone in vain, right? But the real help is to give them the understanding of God. Like, yes, it's good that you're treating the sick people and ailing people, but if you give them the understanding of God, then even though they will die someday, but they will actually conquer death. They will not die. Because by establishing their relationship with God, they'll become situated in their spiritual identity and they'll attain immortality. Therefore, I will say that all the good things that you're doing, they're naturally very, very praiseworthy. But please do something more beyond that. That is, please develop your relationship with God. By doing that, you will help yourself and you'll be able to help others in a real way. An example is given, like if you water the root of the tree, then aren't you serving the entire tree? So similarly, God is the root of everything. Now if we serve Him, then every body becomes served. Now you may say, how is it possible? I will say, please try to do that and you'll see it yourself. How is it possible? How it really happens? As you asked me, are you doing the right thing? Yes, you are doing the right thing, Am I right in my thinking? In a way, you are right in your thinking. You are doing good thing. But it is not the ultimate good. Now, say you are good, as you are saying, my work is my worship. Right? Now, you may say that, well, because you are a good man, you are doing good things to others. It is good. You can say that your work is your worship. But if somebody is involved in some bad work, then following your principle, if he says, my work is my worship, will it be accepted? Like in that case, you remember the story of Ratnakar? Ratnakar was a bandit. He was a dacoit. Then one day Narad Muni was traveling through the forest. Narad Muni was traveling through the forest and Ratnakar actually caught Narad Muni and he wanted to rob him of whatever he had. And so Narad Muni just asked him, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? He said, this is my occupation. This is how I maintain my family. He said, okay, this may be your occupation, but did you ever consider the amount of sinful reactions that you are accruing? And he said, well, I know my actions are sinful, but I'm doing it for my family. Then Narad Muni asked, will your family members share your sinful reactions? He said, naturally they will. He said, why don't you go and ask them? Ratnakar thought that he was trying to outsmart him. He was going to escape by sending him home. So when he told that to Narad Muni, Narad Muni said, okay, you can tie me up to the tree and I'll wait for you. So he went home and he asked his family members. He asked his father, he asked his wife, he asked his children. No one was prepared to accept his sinful reactions. Then Ratnakar realized what a big mistake he made. And so many sinful reactions he is becoming liable to. Therefore, he came back to Narad Muni and fell at his feet and asked him, please tell me how can I get rid of my sinful reactions? And Narad Muni then advised him to chant the holy name of Lord Ramchandra. So this is how, by surrendering ourselves to the Lord, we actually derive the ultimate benefit of our life. Like there are some good people, they're good work, but that's not enough. There are so many bad people doing so many bad things, you know, and if work becomes their worship, then, you know, I mean, we can't accept that. No sane person will accept that the bad works. So if somebody is a thief or a bandit, if he says that his work is his worship, will you accept that killing people is his kind of worship? No. But acting according to the instructions of God is the ultimate worship. Okay, thank you very much. Well, so I think I answered all the questions. Oh, there are some more questions. Okay. Is Krishna consciousness sectarian? Why is it not Allah or Messiah consciousness? Okay. You see, Krishna is the name of God. Similarly, Allah is the name of God. Messiah, of course, is not the name of God. Messiah means the messenger. So, the messenger who carried the words of God, he also came and gave the same instructions. There's no doubt about it. But God has many names according to his qualities and activities. Like in English, you can consider one of the names of God is omnipotent. Isn't it? Who is omnipotent? God is omnipotent. And this omnipotency is synonymous to his quality, one of his qualities. Therefore, that's one of his names. In this way, God has many, many names. But of all his names, Krishna is the most complete and most fulfilling. This name indicates that he is all attractive. And attraction is synonymous to love. And since we have to develop our loving relationship, his attractive feature is most appealing and most important. That's why our society is named as the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Our purpose is to develop or enable people to develop their love for God. That's why it is Krishna Consciousness. He's all attractive and everyone is attracted to him. But when you say Allah, Allah means the greatest. Who is greatest? Naturally, God is the greatest. No doubt about that. And they're indicating the same personality. There's no doubt about that. But somebody who is great, so big, you can't really love him. That greatness, the majestic aspect of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, causes awe and reverence. And awe and reverence is a hindrance to a loving relationship. That's why it is not the International Society for Allah Consciousness. Krishna or Rama, a god or God, is something more. They were just incarnations of God. It means, is it justice to view God as Krishna or Rama, or is it something which can be expressed, described or proved? You see, God is a person. And he has his identity. And as I mentioned just a little while ago, that identity is addressed by his devotees according to his qualities. Like Rama means all pleasure, or the giver of the supreme pleasure and the supreme enjoyer. Now tell me, who is the giver of the supreme pleasure? Huh? Tony Blair? George Bush? Amitabh Bachchan?
Can be Mother.
Okay, that's a good point. You see, God is, in Sanskrit, God is identified as Bhagavan. The suffix "ban" is indicative of a male person. Female is "bati." Therefore, God is identified as a male person. Is that your question? Okay. Okay. So you mean okay? So that's, you see, when we say Ram or Krishna, they're indicative of their qualities and their pastimes. The same person, as you said, incarnation. Incarnation means he descends. He resides in the spiritual reality, but he comes down to the material nature to accomplish certain objective. And that is called, when he comes down here, that is called avatar in Sanskrit, or incarnation. He can expand himself into innumerable forms, because he is all powerful. Which is a better way to achieve him? By bhakti, karma, or jnana? Very good question from Amitabh Sen. Who is Amitabh? Okay. Come forward, Amitabh. Yes. Sit down. Sit there. So, which is the best way to achieve him? By bhakti, karma, and or jnana. You see, karma and jnana, just karma means action, right? And jnana means endeavor for knowledge. So any action or any endeavor for knowledge is not karma yoga. When the karma or action becomes mixed with bhakti, then it becomes karma yoga. When endeavor for knowledge is mixed with bhakti, then it is called jnana yoga. Right? But the purpose of karma and jnana is to ultimately become linked with the Lord, becoming free from both karma and jnana. And that is, free from karma and jnana. Bhakti free from karma and jnana is called Suddha Bhakti or pure devotion. Now the pure devotion is the best way because that is the way to become connected to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Like, did you read Bhagavad Gita? Did you read that in Bhagavad Gita that Krishna is saying that Bhaktya Mam Abhijanati? Through devotion only one can get to know me. Right? Through devotion only one can come to me. Kaunteya pratijanihi na me bhakta pranashyati. Krishna never said that na me karma yogi pranashyati or jnana yogi pranashyati. It's a pure devotion that actually is the means to become connected to Krishna. Now, that doesn't mean, I don't want to say that, I am, in order to establish pure devotion, I am rejecting karma and jnana. Rather, karma and jnana are the two stages. In our scriptures, karma and jnana have been described as different rungs. Different yogas are the different rungs of a ladder. The purpose of the ladder is to take us to the roof. And different rungs are the means to go up, right? Now, when our endeavor is to act on the with our faculty, with our physical faculty, but when those actions are offered, the results of those actions are offered to the Lord, then it is karma yoga, right? See, the propensity is in us to act, and we are being propelled by the propensity to act. We are being compelled to act, but at the same time we are offering the results of our actions to Krishna. That is karma yoga, right? When the propensity to know, to acquire knowledge is there, but the purpose of the knowledge is Krishna, then it is jnana yoga, right? But you see, eventually karma yoga, one transcends the karma yoga and comes to the platform of jnana yoga. Like, through karma yoga, the purpose of karma yoga again is to enjoy the material world. Why do we act? To exploit this world, right? But we are trying to exploit, this is our tendency, this is our propensity, but we are offering the results to Krishna. But eventually we get to realize, why are we just acting like this out of our own volition? But actually we don't need to. Let us stop all the activities and let's try to understand who Krishna is, to whom I've been offering all the results of my action. Now through this endeavor, we come to a point when we realize that by our knowledge, by our intellect, we'll never be able to understand Krishna. Right? Then we give up that endeavor also. And then we just surrender ourselves to Krishna. That Krishna, I know you are there. I know you are the supreme controller and you are the supreme benefactor. You are my supreme protector. And I am surrendering myself to you, knowing well that you are my supreme Lord and Master. And that is called surrender or sharanagati, and that's the beginning of pure devotion. So this is how one actually transcends different rungs of yogas to come to the platform of pure bhakti. Thank you very much, Amitabha. Yes?
Very difficult to understand the subject matter of spirituality. And to understand God is even more difficult.
Why doesn't God Himself come down, show His form and take us back to Godhead?
He did. But you are keeping your eyes closed. So how can... He came down so many times.
What about us?
He is still there. He is sitting in your heart. He is waiting for you to turn your face towards him. He is just waiting for you to turn your face towards him. But if you say, I don't want to see you, then he says, okay, carry on the way you are doing. You see, his situation is like a father who is just, you know, waiting for his son to stop his childish activities and just turn towards him. Doesn't it happen often? The father takes the child to the playground and let the child play with his friends, and he sits there on the bench still watching how his son is faring. And then the child plays, he completely forgets about his father, his home, his everything. He forgets about eating and then, you know, it gets dark, all his friends are gone. Then he becomes afraid and he calls out, Daddy, Daddy, where are you? The father comes and picks him up. So similarly, Krishna is waiting for us, sitting in our heart. Why Krishna is sitting in our heart as a super soul? He's simply waiting for us to turn our face towards him. All we have to say, Krishna, Krishna, please help me, take me back to you. And you see, then you see what happens? Please try that. Okay.
I think the father, forefathers, everybody couldn't understand the subject matter.
It's up to your father and forefather whether they tried to understand or not. I don't know, I can't comment. Yes. Yes, he is the creator of everything, but he is not created. He is always there. You may think so many things, but it's not a matter of what you think. It's not a matter of what you think. The reality is what it is. Right? Try to find out what is the reality. You may think that the sun doesn't exist, but does it matter? You may think that the sun rises in the north. Does it matter? The thing is, if you really want to know, then you submit yourself to the process. Right? If you want to learn something, what do you do? What did you study? Computer science. So did you have to learn it from somebody? Yeah. So now, to learn computer science, you had to make so much endeavor. So if you want to know about God, how can you think that you, without making any endeavor, you will get to know him? Is it? Very good. Yeah. Then just ponder, as I told you earlier, ponder over the points that I made. If you really want to learn, then the things that I have said this evening, please think about it. If you really want to know, study some books that we can prescribe you. Did you read any of Prabhupada's books? Did you read it? Okay. Okay, please, you have the Bhagavad Gita, please read it. Read it and then I'll ask you. You read it and then you can ask me whether it did answer all the questions you have. Yes, it will answer all your questions. Please read it. Read the Bhagavad Gita as it is. That's why Prabhupada's Gita is so important. It's Bhagavad Gita as it is. Yeah, please. Read that one only. Right? Okay. Sure. Please do. I'll be happy to answer your questions. You see, we are here. I mean,
you said that everything is created by somebody, so we must also be created.
Yeah, and that is the most wonderful aspect about him, that he had always been there. He is the one who created everything, but he doesn't have a creator. And another thing is, you see, the material concept of creation won't apply to the spiritual reality. That is another dimension altogether. And with the material concept, we won't be able to understand the spiritual reality. Here the creation means something was not there and something just come. But in the spiritual platform, everything had been existing forever. How do you like the point that even you are not created? No, the thing is, you had been existing forever and you will never die. That is the spiritual reality. Yes. No, the point is when you yourself haven't been created as such, according to the material concept of creation that you have, how can you understand the concept that God has, no one has created God? God has always been there. That is the spiritual reality. It's eternal. Eternal means it doesn't have any beginning, nor does it have any end. Okay, read Bhagavad Gita. All right? Please, huh? Yes. Yeah. give him the mic.
With the view of reward or done for the reward is much lower in nature than work done in the name of God. But nowadays when reward forms the motivation of work, why is it wrong? Why shouldn't we work for the reward?
You can. He's not rejecting that. He's saying if you want to work for reward, go ahead and do it. But even better than that is acting without expecting any reward. Like it's like, you know, the child... The father says, that tells the child, that you do this, I'll give you this. But when the child grows up, then he doesn't need any incentive of that nature. You know, he realizes, you know, whatever his father is asking him to do is for his benefit. So he just does it, you know, without any question. So similarly, in the earlier stage, at an initial stage of his spiritual life, one may want some reward. But if he continues properly, then a time will come when he won't expect any reward. When you see that, I mean, without even asking, he's giving us so much, why should I unnecessarily ask anything from him? Right. Okay, so I'll stop now. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. So I will... Oh, you have another question? Yeah, please. Everything is? Where everything is?
When everything is just to happen, why should we die for doing something? This is the question. Why should you work?
When everything is fixed, when everything is destined to happen.
Yeah.
You see, everything is destined to happen means the way you have acted in the past, accordingly you are going to get the reward. Please keep standing.
Yeah.
It helps me to see you and give the answer. So when everything is destined to happen, the destiny is actually caused by our previous actions. Right? So, in this way, you know, good actions are giving us good results, bad actions are giving us bad results. Right? But that doesn't mean we should stop acting. The idea is that recognize the fact that the way you are acting accordingly, you'll get the results. Therefore, act properly. If you act improperly, then you're inviting misery. But you don't want to become miserable. You don't want to suffer. So be careful how you're acting. Right? And the way you have acted in the way you have worked in the past, accordingly, you are getting your present reactions. Right? Nothing is happening by accident or chance. Thank you. So you can have a little kirtan now. And then, please take prasad. Thank you. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.